We've already talked about different forms of cartels as the term is going along, farm price supports and all the rest of it. We'll now go again to various types of cartels the government enforces. So internal pressure and external pressure have broken up every cartel. Without exception, the only cartels which have lasted have been government cartels, like OPEC, which is the first cartel of different governments. Even OPEC is finally busted after, 12, 13 years. Even they couldn't hack the fact that new countries were coming in with new production, Britain and Mexico and so forth, which are not part of OPEC, which tended to bust the whole thing. So economic law works even with governments, and certainly with private firms, it works much faster. Now, one of the successful cartels is the diamond cartel. Even that has not been that successful recently. What happens in diamonds is all wholesale diamonds are routed through South Africa, De Beers, a company in South Africa, which then sells wholesale diamonds to the diamond markets in Amsterdam, etc. But they, Rotterdam, yeah, and they and they sell. I think Amsterdam too is a big diamond center, and they sell. They regulate the flow. That was to keep the supply drastically limited through De Beers cartel. Now, what's happened to several things happened to that cartel. First place, a few years ago, the whole diamond market busted. The demand curve collapsed, and the price of diamonds went way down. So even the cartel, a world diamond cartel, is not all powerful because it has to face fluctuating consumer desires, etc. Other jewelry, all sorts of jewels in a sense are competing with diamonds. Another thing is this, that the reason why De Beers is able to do this, because South Africa has most of the diamonds are found in South Africa. I was going to say grown. Anyway, they're discovered in South Africa. The way South African government enforces this, it's done by the South African government, not by De Beers. De Beers is the beneficiary. The way they do it is this. In South Africa, all diamond land is nationalized. In other words, if you're a farmer, you're Joe Jones or Jaap Schroeder, whoever it is in South Africa, okay, and you find diamonds in your land, those diamonds are now part of government-owned. They immediately become part of the government. The whole diamond mine or ore or whatever is nationalized. Okay, so first South African government nationalizes all the diamonds. Then they lease the diamonds to favored lessees. They lease the mines to who? To De Beers, basically. In other words, De Beers has got the monopoly lessee, plus a few other large diamond firms are in with the cartel, which essentially are allied to the Beers. Nobody else can get a license to mine diamonds. So if you're a farmer, you're Jaap Schroeder, you decide, well, the hell of the government monopoly, I'm going to sell these diamonds. You're shot, literally shot, because they patrol the coast of South Africa. It's patrolled with the Coast Guard. Very rigorous patrol to catch so-called diamond smugglers. These diamond smugglers are people trying to get their own diamonds out, basically, and to sell them, to break the cartel there. Coast is patrolling, they're shot. There was a good British film a few years ago, some big star in it, about the diamond, South African diamond business. And it talks about this. And so, of course, it doesn't go into the cartel part very much. It talks about being shot by the Coast Guard and all that. So diamond smuggling, quote-unquote, is really people trying to engage in free trade, is what it really amounts to, trying to bust the cartel. So in other words, the successful cartel, first of all, it's not too super successful because the consumers can lower the price and have done it. Second of all, it's only successful because the South African government enforces it through this kind of arrangement where the Beers is leasing the diamond mines from. They don't own the mine, they lease it from the South African government, which automatically owns it. About 10, 20 years ago, Soviet Russia discovered diamonds. So there was a big panic in the international diamond cartel. What are they going to do? Russia might bust the market, bust the price, you say. Russia, however, being monopolists themselves, in this case state monopolists, were very happy to get cut in as a part of the quota. In other words, they're happy to get cut. So Russia sells their diamonds to the South African government cartel, even though allegedly are opposed to the South African government politically. When it comes to business, it all was a happy combination of monopolists. In other words, they got a chunk of the quota, so to speak. So that's the mystery whenever you see a successful cartel, look to government enforcement, and sure enough, there's where it was. Another thing that's come into the news yesterday was the fact that heroic one of my heroes in the movies, Clint Eastwood, became mayor of Carmel, California. Okay. Elected by 2.5-1, 70%, kicking out the previous mayor. Now, the issue in which he fought the race on was very simple. It was anti-government cartelism. In other words, the town, if you've ever been to Carmel, it's a beautiful little town on the Pacific. It's been a tight stranglehold of a bunch of upper-class liberals who essentially are residing in the town and run it, keeping down all growth. In other words, they're trying to prevent any kind of expansion, any kind of business growth or whatever. So they, in other words, the whole thing is sort of a big zoning cartel. The zoning laws are used as a way of restricting production, keeping supply of almost everything to the left, supply of houses, supply of trade, merchants, stores, whatever. So Clint Eastwood owned a restaurant in Cartel and Carmel. What he wanted to do was expand it. He wanted to get permission to expand it a little bit. They refused to do it because they have a very severe anti-growth policy in Carmel. If you've ever been to Carmel, you'll see why. And so he ran on a basis of a free market ticket, in other words, to bust the anti-growth zoning cartel is what it really amounts to. He doesn't use the word cartel, but that's what it is. So he mobilized the masses and ran and won by 2-1. So at any rate, what you have all through the United States, on a local level and on a federal level, is this kind of compulsory cartel in various areas. In this case, it's compulsory housing and zoning cartel is what it amounts to. California, by the way, is shot with that. I mean, shot through with housing cartels. You try to keep out people you don't like by zoning them out of existence, or zoning them, preventing them from coming in, what it amounts to. Another case of compulsory cartel is, there's a whole bunch of cases. Licensing in general example of almost every business is now licensed. I mean, everything you can think of. And the licensing is always the excuse for license. What's the excuse? The excuse, of course, is the public welfare, common good. The excuse is we have to protect the public by licensing this profession. The medical profession, it sounds more plausible than other professions. It's not the real reason for medical licensing either, but in some cases, it's obviously idiotic. Like, photographers are licensed. Why do you have to have only licensed photographers? My brother-in-law, for example, is an excellent photographer. He doesn't have a license, because the license is very expensive. He's in the state of Virginia. So the licenses are very expensive. Okay, so you have an expensive license. This, of course, pushes the supply curve of photographers to the left, and raises the price of the consumer. He would like to be a part-time photographer. Okay, he's really a printer. A photographer is a sideline. He's a very good one. He could be, but he can't. He doesn't have enough money to be a license. It's not worth his while to get a full license. So they don't have a Gestapo in Virginia searching every town for photographers. So he can be an illegal photographer, except he can't take out an ad. He can't be on the yellow pages. He can't say photographer, et cetera, et cetera, because then he'd be on the state licensing bureau crack down on him. His business is restricted by the fact that he can't advertise and he can't make it public. So this is what happens. The purpose of licenses is to keep out, push the supply curve to the left, keep out new entrants. What I mean. And one of the things about licenses we'll see time and again here is, and Miller mentions this, is the so-called grandfather clause, grandfathering. Grandfather clause means that you say this profession, whatever it is, this occupation, needs to be licensed because we have to serve the public and have to make sure, for example, photographers are of good moral character or they're heavily educated, whatever the heck it is. Okay, they've taken 3 years of courses in some photography school. Well, these restrictions are coming. They're not applied to existing people. Existing people are grandfathered out. In other words, let's say you pass a law in Virginia that in order to be a photographer, you have to go 2 years to a photography school. Okay? Licensed photography school. I mean, it's very expensive. This pushes the supply curve to the left. And then you say, existing photographers are exempt from this regulation. So this is a blatant, monopolistic, cartelistic thing. In other words, obviously it has nothing to do with the public welfare, because if you want to serve the public welfare, you apply to everybody, including to existing photographers. It's really important that photographers get a university education, or they learn about physics or something like that. Then you make it apply to everybody. No, it only applies to new people coming in. That's the tip-off. The whole thing is a racket. The grandfather clause is a tip-off to the racketeering nature of licensing. Now, for example, in the barbering profession, what they do is, you see, every 20 years or so, they increase the requirements, because the new generation comes in, they want to be grandfathered too. So every 20 years or every 15 years, there's a big increase in tightening of requirements in almost every profession. Barbering is a marvel. I unfortunately lost the clipping. There's a great little story about barbering, history of barbering. Initially, of course, barbers are not licensed. You become a barber. Let's say you cut hair and that's it. If you're good, if you're a lousy haircutter, you go out of business. If you're a good haircutter, you stay in business. At any rate, the barbers got together and in a guild and they began to lobby for licensing. And every 10 years, they raised the restrictions. In other words, initially, you had to go for 6 months to a barbering school. And then 10 years later, you have to go a year to barbering school. I think now it's like 3.5 years to barbering school. You have to pass courses in the history of barbering. like you have to take 104 here, right? History of barbering, barbering technology in the 1600s. Now you have to pass courses in the ethics of barbering, as if barbering has its own ethics. You don't cut the guy's neck, I guess, let's say. Anyway, you know, right? Huh? That's right. It's like 101. It's like any tightening of requirements, and in each case, the existing people are exempt. Now, in each case, you say, well, from now on, everybody's got to pass a course in history of barbering, but the existing barbers don't have to do it. That, again, it's a tip off, it's a racket. And so every 5 or 10 years, they keep increasing the requirements. You have to be a citizen. The minimum age keeps going up. It used to be 16 or 17, now it's about 21 or something like that. They keep raising the age, increasing the educational requirements. You have to be a citizen, and God knows what. There's all sorts of ways to restrict entry into the profession. In Chicago, but the thing of Chicago is a very heavy unionized town, much more than New York, and much more guild operated. In Chicago, technically, if the law were really followed, it'd be illegal to shave yourself without a license. Because it says in order to shave anybody, that's anybody, you have to have a license. And so only licensed barber can shave people. So technically it's illegal to shave yourself in Chicago. And I can see the Gestapo in Chicago breaking into everybody's home. You're shaving yourself. You're under arrest. You're not a licensed barber. So fortunately, of course, these are not enforced, these insane requirements, but they're part of the law. You know, a lot of people think if it's part of the law, it should be enforced at the hilt. Well, that's part of the law in Chicago. It's not being enforced at the hilt. There's a lot of laws like that, by the way. If your crazy laws are simply have died out, even though they're still on the books. But this shows you how far the licensing situation goes. For example, if you're a photographer, you have to be, or any, most of these, like, you have to be certified as of good moral character. What does that mean? Some board of photographers in Virginia are certifying everybody of good, what do they know about moral character anyway? Why are they experts in morality? But all this is part of this whole gimmick. Yeah?
Does that mean that anybody wants
No, it depends on each occupation. I mean, some are, for example, in New York, they're constantly trying to crack down on peddlers. I might have mentioned this before. That's part of the whole thing. See, one of the things I want to tell you about competition, it's not necessarily true that small businesses can be outcompeted by big business. In many areas, small businesses are more efficient, are better able to compete than big businesses. For example, retailing in general. Peddlers can often outcompete retail stores because peddlers can come in when they're not there on the corner when it's raining. They have a lower capital requirement. They don't have to pay rent. They have to pay fixed equipment, right? They can nip in with one day supply of purses or scarves and sell it. And if it's raining, they don't show up. So they're mobile, highly mobile. And they can often outcompete retail stores to the extent that retail stores are always trying to outlaw them. And insisting on special licenses on peddlers, hot dog stands, whatever. So many of these guys are constantly, every once in a while, the mayor, whoever the mayor is, announces a crackdown on peddlers. Peddlers are great. I think peddlers are fantastic. They're cheaper. The stuff is, of course, much cheaper. We have in our neighborhood, for example, a magnificent florist, an illegal florist who's been selling flowers in St. Corner for many years. I mean, you go to an official licensed florist and a bouquet or something costs $10. With him, it's $1.50. That's magnificent. Plus, he's got better, fresher stuff. The organized florists are trying to always put him out of business. They get the cops on. Of course, he pays off the cops. So there's a contest between who gets, you know, the official pressure. And every once in a while, the mayor says, we've got to crack down on the peddlers. What's wrong with the peddlers? Well, he says they spoil the beauty of this New York City streets. It's great. I mean, New York City has many advantages, but beautiful streets is not one of them. Okay. So the whole thing is obviously an absurd argument, which you use any sort of argument, because of the pressure of inefficient retail stores who can't compete for these guys. So it's not, and peddlers are the smallest possible business. They have one day supply of capital. In some cases, all they have is like a suitcase. They spread out the stuff, and that's it. They don't even have a push cart. Push cart is already a high status symbol in the peddling profession. It means you have enough money to buy a push cart. And yet they're magnificent. It's a great way to, for immigrants to rise up in the world. Has been in the past before licensing. And also a great way to compete. It's marvelous for the consumer and for those who want opportunity. But of course, organized retailing, by the way, has always been trying to outlaw their competition. It's been going on for over 100 years. Every innovation in the retail industry, every successful technological innovation has been combated legally by the organized interests in the retail field. For example, in the mid-19th century, when railroads first came in, okay, when the first time we had cheap transportation and over land. And so when railroads came in, the institution of traveling salesmen came in, where stores, wholesalers in New York, let's say, or Chicago, would send traveling salesmen out with sample cases to show to the various retailers. Well, the organized wholesalers, let's say in Dayton, Ohio, didn't like the fact that traveling salesmen were suddenly popping up, competing with them. In other words, New York stores can now compete with our wholesalers, can now compete with Dayton. So they had taxes to put them out of business, special license fees. They said they were evil. It was a terrible thing. It's unfair competition to have traveling salesmen. And this, by the way, is the reason, the origin of traveling salesmen, dirty traveling salesmen jokes, because traveling salesmen are usually in a state of illegality because they're trying to evade $1,000. For example, they would have to pay like $1,000 a year license fees to operate in each town, and they're only making about $3,000 a year, so obviously they couldn't pay it. So they try to slip in and out of town unseen, you see, before the wholesaler can get after them, the wholesale competitors. So for about 20 or 30 years, the traveling salesmen were basically illegal. And finally, the Supreme Court says it's unconstitutional, and they were finally relieved of these special taxes and license fees. Then after they were finally absorbed, and the wholesalers, and they started employing traveling salesmen, you see, too. So the whole thing began to finally get accepted. Then after they were accepted, about 1890 or so, a new institution comes in, the department store. And that was hysteria directing a terrible, unfair competition is more than one floor. Terrible thing is selling more than one product and blah, blah, blah. Outlaw them, tax them. So about 20 or 30 years, there were special taxes placed on department stores and attempts to outlaw them. And then the same thing happened with mail order. My God, mail order. They can buy stuff by mail, Sears Roebuck and Montgomery Ward. They don't even have to hire salesmen. That's unfair. Because they can just send catalogs out. They can sit there in Chicago and sell you stuff. Terrible thing, because consumers loved it. But all over the United States, there were bonfire parties to burn Sears Roebuck catalogs. It would be unfair competition organized by the rotten retailers in each area who claim they're going to be put out of business by evil Montgomery Ward and evil Sears Roebuck. Finally, they were accepted. Okay, and then comes the chain store. The same damn thing happens to them. About 1920s, the first chain store started. A&P was the major chain. Liberals were calling for breaking up A&P. A&P is a monopoly. They're evil. Break them up because they can sell stuff at a cheaper because they're getting discounted, volume discounts. They can buy stuff cheaper. When I was growing up, liberals in the United States were calling for the breakup of A&P. Well, that was finally rendered obsolete by the supermarkets, which came in. A&P, of course, the last people to understand the importance of the supermarket, the last people to clue in on it. They were still mired in the old chain store technology, and so they fell behind. They were outcompeted by these newcomers like Safeway and Grand Union and so forth. And even right now, A&P stores are usually the worst in the city. They still have the crummy wooden floors and all the rest of it. It's the dirtier. And so they almost went out of business. They almost went bankrupt, so-called monopolists. They didn't have to be broken up. They fell behind in the competitive race because like many big business, I should say, they didn't understand they weren't alive to new developments. Supermarkets can also be a chain, but the chain was, you had mom and pop stores. Okay, you go to the counter, you ask for 2 pounds of butter or something. Okay? There are very few of them left. There's some neighborhood stores like that still. The chain stores, you still had to go to the counter and ask them, but they were, different, there are branches all over the place, and each one was more impersonal. You couldn't get credit as well. They were cheaper. On the other hand, you couldn't get credit. They didn't know you and that sort of stuff. Deliveries weren't as, so they're trade-offs. A lot of people still prefer the mom-and-pop stores because they get cheaper credit. They can deliver it at night or whatever it is. But then you see when supermarkets came in, it was really self-service, which was a great, tremendous new concept after World War II. It was really unheard of. You didn't have to go and ask the guy to get the stuff. It was a great, great development. And A&P fell behind on that. Yeah, they finally did it, sure. But they almost went bankrupt. In fact, reduced a lot of their stores because of that. So, at any rate, so in the region, and after that, after the chain stores were finally accepted, and the supermarkets were accepted, then they started bellyaching about discount houses, which were the last big innovation in the 1950s and 60s. They used to have, and I get, they had, this is, by the way, is put in by the trade, by the retail associations, trade associations. Resale price maintenance laws came in the 1930s as an alleged anti-depression device, and of course continued 30 years after the depression was over. Resale price maintenance laws meant that if a manufacturer signed a contract with a retailer, let's say, to sell some appliance for a certain amount, for a certain minimum price, let's say sell an electric shaver for no less than $30, then no other retailer could cut the price any place, even though he wasn't bound by any contract. The law then imposed a minimum price for these products for all retailers all over the country. This is the so-called resale price maintenance law. So why not? A manufacturer really doesn't care. Why should a manufacturer, if you're a Sunbeam company and you're selling shavers, why should you care what the retail price is as long as you get your price that you want from the wholesaler or the jobber? And so they didn't care. What happened was the organized retail associations went to Sunbeam and said, look, we'll boycott you. We won't buy Sunbeam unless you impose a minimum price of whatever it was, $30 or whatever. So in other words, the whole idea was to restrict production and raise price. And inefficient retailers wanted to screw the consumer by organizing a cartel and getting the federal government and state governments along with them imposed the cartel through resale price maintenance laws, which said once the manufacturer announces the price, everybody's committed to it. Retailers can't cut it. So finally what happened was that two heroic so-called discount houses in New York, Masters and Corvette, simply started cutting prices. They said, hell with it. We defy the law. We challenge the constitutionality of it. They started selling stuff way below, much cheaper. And the way they were able to do it is by no-frill salesmanship, of course. In other words, instead of having a salesman at your beck and call, what do you want, sir, et cetera, you had to line up like you do now with, you know, 47th Street Photo, et cetera. You have to know what you want ahead of time. You're going and line up and pay for it. And so that was enabled them to cut the cost, to cut the price. And so they started undercutting. It was magnificent. Everybody flocked, of course, to Masters and Corvette and went out to the Supreme Court. The retailers, the organized retailers, fought it bitterly. They hated this thing. It's horrible. It's unfair. And blah, blah, blah. It's monopolistic. Here's another favorite argument of these guys. They say, well, look, if you allow free competition, and cartelists always say, if you allow free competition, eventually some firms will get very big and put the other firms out of business, and then they'll raise the price. In other words, their argument is to preclude the possibility of an efficient monopoly 20 years from now, which will eventually raise price. Let's enforce an inefficient monopoly right now. Let's have a government cartel forcing you to raise the price. An obviously idiotic argument, which can only be held by somebody who's doing this to impose an inefficient cartel on their own behalf. I mean, you look at it logically, the whole thing's idiotic. So it's only pushed by people who are special pleaders for this thing. So this is their argument. If you can't, it'd be a terrible thing. Larger retailers will take over and they'll be efficient. They'll finally eventually raise the price. Of course, they eventually never come. Prices get lowered by competition. So at any rate, this guy, the Masters of Corvette, were hated by everybody. They were attacked by all the retailers. And finally, the Supreme Court said, you're right. Resale price maintenance laws are unconstitutional. And since the 1960s, since the 1960s, discount housing has been accepted. I mean, now everybody discounts, especially in New York. As a matter of fact, Corvette just went bankrupt a year or two ago because they had no function. I mean, everybody was discounting. They were no longer a special place. So New York, by the way, were very fortunate. Most places in the country don't have these discounts. You don't have electronic discount places and things like that. So this is again an example of innovation, of retailing, in this case the retail industry, battling against compulsory cartels. They have to be compulsory in order to work at all and trying to, you know, breaking through this whole crust of cartelism. There still is, I don't know how it is with vitamins now, but there used to be a very tight anti-discounting for vitamins in the name of health. I remember when I was, I used to get Theragran vitamins, which were just Squibb's Theragran, which is multiple vitamins. Of course, the list price those days, it might still be about $10, which is totally insane. So They were selling it for about $6, the market price about $6. So I went into this drugstore, neighborhood drugstore, and said, I like Theragun. The guy looked at me and said, you live in the neighborhood? A strange question you might think to ask. I said, yes. And he said, yes, I've seen you around. He then sold me the vitamins for $6 instead of $10. In other words, what he was worried about, I might be a Gestapo member. In other words, a member of a secret police of whatever they call them, so the Federal Food and Drug, or whatever bureau in New York regulates the retail industry, to go around and make sure the vitamins are sold at no less than list price. In other words, minimum price control espionage agents. At the behest, of course, of the retailers, the organized retailers, the cartel, which doesn't want any given retail store to bust the price. So, of course, this is now busted. Man, nobody sells for $9. I've never seen any Theragun for $9, $10. It's all about $5 or $6. So that, too, was busted. But it's intriguing that even in New York here, we had a situation where you have to make sure the guy is safe, that I'm a neighborhood person, not some floating spy for the local bureau. So anyway, this is, now of course there are discounts all over in vitamins, but this is still going on for the liquor business, the liquor trust. It's been loosened a little bit recently, but basically what you have is the liquor industry, retail liquor store, the supply is tightly controlled. You have to get a license. First of all, there are no new liquor licenses, so it's very much like the taxi business, which we'll get to in a minute. There's only a fixed amount of retail liquor store licenses. Since they don't issue any more, suppose you want to open up a liquor store, you can only do it by buying some other existing liquor store's license. Some liquor store owner wants to retire, or go out of business, or sell out. You have to buy his liquor license. So it costs, many thousands of dollars, whatever it is. It's an enormous amount of money to be able to open up, to have the right to open up a liquor store. So in other words, the supply of liquor stores is rigidly fixed. This, of course, raises the price, obviously. In addition to that, there's minimum distance requirements. In other words, you can't open a liquor store less than 100 yards or 200 yards, whatever it is, from some other liquor store, giving this existing liquor store some crummy geographical monopoly of 3 blocks or whatever it is. What's important in New York, 3 blocks is a lot. So in other words, you can't invade his turf. So again, it's a pure cartel. It's not true of any other business, of course. You can open up a grocery store right across the street from another one. But in the case of a clothing store or whatever, in the case of liquor, however, it's specially regulated by the New York State Liquor Authority. And so you've got geographical monopoly. When I first moved into my neighborhood on the west side, there was one big liquor store here. There's another fairly large one there. There's a teeny, lovable teeny one right here, right next door to me. And the teeny one was put out of business by these two guys who got together, complained to the liquor authority they were less than 100 yards, whatever it is, from the other two. And they were put out of business. They were expelled from, ejected from business by the state government under the lobbying of these two competitors. This is the welfare state in action. this is the welfare state. This is government regulation for the common good, quote unquote. It's the government being used by these two competitors to screw their third competitor to cartelize the system, keep out competition. So that's the real monopoly problem. The real monopoly problem is not a falling demand curve. The real monopoly problem, which everybody has, the real monopoly problem is the government being used to restrict or eliminate competition. And the liquor field, by the way, you also have, of course, very high liquor taxes, plus liquor import controls, and the result of which is the price of liquor is enormously higher than it would be in the free market. It's incredible. The price of liquor before the Civil War, when extra liquor taxes came in because of the prohibitionists, a gallon of top scotch you can get for about $1, and that's, of course, let's say the price is now eight times higher than that. You probably get a gallon of top Chivas Regal or something for about $8, I would think, on the free market. Yeah, without the taxes, I would think it'd be something like that. Yeah. Hmm? On the free market, I'm not talking about now. I'm talking about without taxes, without import tariffs. Yeah. Yeah. That's it. Okay, so I'll leave you with that happy thought. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break. A liquor store, liquor license is the same status as a liquor store license, same status as a tobacco farm license and also a taxi license. We get to one of my favorite examples, a great taxi caper, which is now in the news. If I've said this before, I'll repeat it on the taxi question. In the 1920s, there were 25,000 taxis on the streets of New York. Okay? In order to get a taxi, in order to get a taxi license, you had to be licensed. All you needed to do is be able to show you could drive a car. So you needed a driver's license plus a car. You had to access to a car. And then you went downtown and got a 10-buck license. And the license is... And then you're in business and you operate a taxi. In the 1930s, the number of taxis went down from 25,000 during the boom of the 20s to 11,787. In 1937, the taxi owners in New York, the Associated Taxi Association, went to New York City and said, we need some help in the Great Depression. We need to be bailed out. And the help was that the New York City government said, okay, from now on, we issue no further taxi licenses. Now, from that day, from 1937 until 1986, that's 39 years, no more taxi licenses have been issued in the city of New York. That's it. The number of taxi licenses has been frozen, like by divine edict in 1937, has never increased since. There we sit. Greatest boom in American history, tremendous boom in income and employment, whatever. We still have the same number of cabs on the street now that we had in 1937. Even though, of course, income is going up. Population in New York City is not going up, but population in suburbs is going way up. There are a lot more people trying to get cabs. So you have then a freezing of supply at the old level, and therefore would ordinarily, of course, have gone up. And so what you're really doing is you're restricting the supply and raising the price, keeping the supply at the 1937 level. It's like, you know, it's as if saying, well, the supply of cars is now, or the supply of bread is now 1937 level, and that's it. So... In order to get a taxi license now, if you want to own a taxi in New York, you have not only to buy a car and then, you know, get it and be able to drive, you also have to buy a taxi license from some existing taxi owner who wants to leave the business because you can't get any more from the city. That's it. Frozen, 11,787. So there's a market. I hesitate to say free market. There's a market in taxi licenses, so-called medallion, which is a shield on the hood of a car. So... If you want to own a taxi, you have to buy a license from some guy who's willing to retire and wants to go on to some other business. And the price has been fluctuating. Of course, in the 1930s, the price was somewhere near $10. There wasn't a big demand to be in the taxi business. But after World War II, when the boom began, people wanted to enter it, and so the price demand curve for, this is taxi licenses, supply, as Miller says, is frozen 11,787, and so the demand fluctuates. It's like the art market, like the demand for Rembrandts. You know, the supply of Rembrandts is fixed because Rembrandt is dead. And supply of taxis is fixed because the goddamn city government won't issue any more licenses. And so we have a fluctuating demand in accordance with all sorts of things, booms and recessions and whatever. Well, the price of a taxi license, well, Miller says the price of a taxi license in the mid-1980s is $60,000. He's way out of date already. The price of a taxi license right now on the market is $105,000. Means if you want to own a cab, and many people are cab drivers, it's also a good immigrant, a way for immigrants to start making a living here. As you well know, if you've ridden in taxis in New York, most people don't know English anymore. Most of the taxi drivers. Can't drive either very well. but the most important thing is to be able to cough up the $105,000 to buy the taxi. Now, many of these drivers, of course, are employees of fleets, but many of them, most of them are taxi owners. And so there we sit. You have to, the market price of a taxi license of medallion is now $105,000. And of course, the result of this is the tremendous shortage of cabs. In other words, a tremendous scarcity of cabs. Rates are up, the price is higher than it would have been. And the supply is way down. This means, of course, the taxi driver is in the saddle just like the rent control landlord is or the butcher under price control. Namely, that if it's raining, if it's rush hour, the cabs put their off-duty signs on. It's like a thrust on the gut of every consumer, right? So-called off-duty sign. And that's it. You can't find a cab anyplace. The cab drivers don't want to go to Brooklyn. They won't go to the Bronx. They won't go to Harlem. They want to hang around Midtown Manhattan, where they maximize their income, because there's no competition. The result of all this was the growth of the so-called gypsy cab movement, the unlicensed cab, illegal cab market. And then the gypsy cabs became quasi-legal. So I think there's three tiers now. There's the gypsy cabs, which are sort of legal now, there's the illegal illegals, and there's the legal illegals. And there's the medallion cabs. The medallion taxis are the only ones that can officially cruise and pick up pick up customers. Other cabs can have been allocated Brooklyn, the Bronx, and whatever, aside from Manhattan. They're basically allowed to cruise in Brooklyn and the Bronx. And still others can call them up, you know, the radio cabs, you can call them up and that's okay, but they can't cruise. Now, of course, in real life, they do cruise, it's not illegally. There's this whole structure, this crazy structure of the taxi industry, all due to the fact that the licenses have, no new licenses have been issued since 1937, for 49 years. Yeah. 39 years? Is it? Yeah, 49 years, but no new taxi license. Every few years, Mayor Koch has tried to increase the number. Like, let's have 100 more. And the taxi drivers are going on strike. They're big hysteria. I'm not sure. What was the thing yesterday? It tied up.
Higher rates.
Great. So, what's happened in the taxi business is, interesting, this has happened with all monopolists in many ways. I said in the long run, all monopolies are inefficient. In the case of a license, the market, and I'll go into this more when we get a little bit later on, next week or two, where you get into what determines the actual price and the market price of this kind of license. When you have a monopoly price, a monopoly license like of this sort, the price on the market tends to absorb the monopoly profits. In other words, if you get a big profit from owning a cab, getting a license, the price of the license goes up to absorb the profit. So that means that the current guy, the guy who spends $105,000 on a cab, he spends so much for the cab, he doesn't feel he's exploiting the public. His profit margin is pretty low because it's true he's getting monopoly profits because he's keeping out other cabs. On the other hand, he has to pay so much for the damn license that absorbs the monopoly profits. So the taxi owners don't think they're exploiting us because they say, well, our profits are low. We're struggling to keep alive, which is true because they have to pay so much for their monopoly license. The result of all of this is the only people who really benefit the taxi monopoly is the original guys, the guys in 1937 who bought a license for $10 and sold it for $105,000. They are the so-called windfall gainers. The guys who hung on to their license for 30 years, they're in great shape. The guys, the newcomers, however, are no better off than anybody else. The result, this kind of system benefits no one and screws up a lot of people. In other words, the consumers are screwed. The people who like to enter the taxi industry and can't because they have to call for $105,000 or borrow $105,000. To get the scratched and to get the license are hurt. And even the beneficiaries don't really benefit anymore. In the long run, in other words, even the monopolists don't benefit because their profits were absorbed in the price of the license they had to buy. And yet they'll fight like hell to keep it because they have $105,000 tied up. In other words, they will fight like tigers to keep any more medallions from being issued because they're afraid the whole $105,000 will go back to $10 where it should be in the first place. And it's the same argument, I don't know if I mentioned this in this class or not, but the same argument, same thing happened under slavery before the Civil War. In other words, in the economics of slavery, the slave was a capital equipment. The slave master was getting monopoly profits. In other words, essentially, as we'll see in a week or so, in the free market, everybody gets their marginal productivity. Everybody gets more or less, the wage rate is equal to the marginal productivity. In the case of slavery, the slave master picked up all of the subsistence, in other words, he collected, so to speak, the productivity, and he paid the slave only subsistence, you know, just about enough to keep going and reproduce. And the difference was the surplus profit, in other words, the surplus value, the exploitation value, so to speak. Well, the slave master, you think the slave master would be making a lot of money because they'd be getting these extra profits from exploiting the slaves. However, after a few decades, what happened was the slaves were bought and sold, and so the price of the slave absorbed the monopoly, the slavery profits. The slave master had to pay so much for the slave, had so much capital tied up in the slave, he felt he wasn't getting any extra profit. He was struggling like everybody else. The result of all this is the slavery system did not benefit anybody, even the slave master, but the slave masters fought like hell to keep it because they had all this money tied up in slavery. It's very much like the taxi industry, of course, much, much more important, you know, economic consequences and political consequences under slavery, but the same economic aspect to it. In other words, you have an exploitative system, a monopoly type system. You're screwing a whole bunch of people to get monopoly profits, and yet the monopoly profits are discounted away by the market, so you wind up with no extra benefits. So the people who benefit are the initial slaves, the guys like the slave traders who bought the slaves over and possibly reap the big profit. But after a while, the slave profits were absorbed in the price of the slave. So yet, of course, they fought like hell to keep it. It's a very similar kind of system. Well, so every once in a while, the mayor, whichever mayor, has been saying, let's increase the number of licenses by 100. and big hysteria goes up. It means you're loosening up this monopoly system. Well, last year, about 2 years ago, Koch had a pretty interesting idea. He said, well, here's what he proposed to do in order to quiet down the hysterical taxi owners. Give them a free license. In other words, you double this amount, okay, 23,000 or whatever, but you give each existing license owner one more license free, and the proviso has to be used either by him or by somebody else within a year or 2 years. In other words, he'll have to sell it. Now, probably these guys would have benefited, because they're getting a free, $305,000 thing. It's true the price would have gone down from $105,000, but still in all, they probably would have benefited. They were so scared about loosening up this tight monopoly and reducing the value, the $105,000 value, that they fought hysterically against it, and finally Koch had to withdraw the suggestion, the idea of giving every existing owner a free medallion, which has to be used. So this is the current situation. Now, the current cookery thing came about. They decided a few years ago to issue 100, just 100, okay, 100 extra medallions to use experimentally in diesel cabs to see how diesel cabs work. Well, of course, what happened was these crooks took the 100 and each one was in those days worth $60,000, that's $6 million, and somehow nobody knows what happened to it. They got dissipated away. The various crooks in the taxi commission. But anyway, so you can imagine, this is an enormous amount of money here. Now, 11,000 medallions, $105,000 each, it's a lot of dough. So there's where we sit. And it's interesting how the market discounts these extra profits. So the price has been going way up, and of course they're all very happy about this. And they're all clinging to every buck they can in this situation. And most cities have one taxi monopoly or other. Los Angeles, you have to be a yellow cab company. They have a literal monopoly. Only the yellow cab companies are allowed to have cabs on the street, and that's it. The only really free market or semi-free market taxi situation is in Washington. If you've ever been to Washington, it's a magnificent taxi town. Even in rush hour, you can get a cab everywhere. It's magnificent. It's great. Because there's free entry into the taxi business. No medallions, no nut. It's true the rates are regulated, but even so, there's a big difference. One of the things about the rates is, by the way, one of the reasons why the gypsy cabs are now quasi-legal is because they don't cut the fare. In other words, they're finally grudgingly accepted by the medallion taxi people because they don't undercut the fare. If they undercut the fare, they'd probably be beaten up and be war on the streets. But since they don't undercut the fare, they're allowed to continue under these restrictions. So that's the... I said, we'll never get a really decent cab service in New York until the taxi monopoly is broken. So we get free entry in the taxi business. I doubt whether it'll ever happen. I'll have to really buy these guys off. And they refuse to be bought off, even as I say, even one free medallion didn't do it. So that's the current setup. By the way, buying them off, most economists say they should be bought off. It's cheaper for the consumer to buy them off. But in many cases, in the case of taxi people, they don't want to be bought off. They're afraid to be bought off. Yeah?
Well, I think I've heard a suggestion that they want to demolish the taxi.
Yeah, because it's filled with crooks. But they'll replace it with something else. It doesn't mean they're going to eliminate them. No, the thing is, the magic number of 11,787 is remaining. I mean, they're not talking about doing away with that, unfortunately. I'd love to see it. Maybe someday they'll be able to do it. But the taxi, there's a vocal minority, a vocal pressure group, and highly politicized because their whole livelihood is wrapped up in the government here and keeping their monopoly. So that's the real problem of monopoly. Once again, it's not a falling demand curve. It's this sort of stuff. So you can't get into the taxi business unless you shell out $105,000 and somebody's already in it. Okay, similar situation as with medical licensing. It's more complicated, medical and hospital licensing, where the real sticking point happened, the real difference occurred in hospital licensing, where medical schools and hospitals were brought under severe regulation around 1910. Abraham Flexner wrote a report for on medical education in 1910, was sponsored by the Carnegie Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation. And his report was there are too many doctors. That's true. He talked a little bit about the quality of education, but basically he's saying that too many, the income of each doctor is too low and should be higher, and the way to make it higher is to restrict the entry. And once again, so we have a systematic situation where the entry supply curve has shifted to the left. There were literally half the medical schools in the country were put out of business. They were not, and licenses were not renewed or not issued by the state governments. Each state set up a medical board. The American Medical Association, the trade union of doctors, so to speak, was given the right to appoint the people. In other words, if you have a state photography board, who's running it? It's the organized photographers, and they run it in a cartelizing manner, of course. Why else run it? So each state, the hospitals, the medical schools were licensed by the state. The AMA had a right to appoint the people, and they, of course, put half of the schools out of business, period. In other words, they shifted the supply drastically to the left. The number of doctors per person is much lower in the United States than it is in most other countries, much lower than it was before 1910. And so you push the supply curve to the left, and you increase, tremendously increase, of course, the income of a physician. One of the things that was done, we have a cartel. Again, in other words, the medical field is an organized cartel, a compulsory cartel, each state running it, in collaboration with the American Medical Association. What happens with a cartel is that, when you have a cartelist, discrimination comes in. This is it's very much like the butcher or the landlord. If you have the right to decide who should be in your apartment, you have 50 people for every apartment, then you pick the guys you like. You pick the race you're interested in favor of or whatever. Same way with the medical profession. When the medical schools were pushed to the left and half of them were put out of business by the government, the doctors then decided, we're going to keep out people we don't like. Who they keep out? Blacks, women, and Jews. These are the three major groups that were forced out of medicine. Before 1910, there were a lot of black medical schools, a lot of female doctors. They were systematically put out of business by the government, the state governments. All the black medical schools were put out of business being quote unqualified unquote. The female schools, those that have female medical students, were put out of business, and so the whole thing shifted. And WASPs basically took over the medical profession for decades. Interestingly enough, the people who took over, and this has been economists engaged in a study of this, in the medical profession, the most monopolistic part of the profession are those which are most connected with the hospitals, because the hospital is the key to this thing, key to the monopoly control, hospital and medical school. So the more hospital-oriented a physician is, the more monopolistic his occupation. Surgeons, for example, are totally hospital-oriented, and the surgeons are the most monopolistic. In other words, they charge the highest fees per income of the customer. For example, dentists are not monopolistic, basically, because they're not connected with hospitals. The dentist will charge more or less the same amount to anybody for pulling a tooth. Surgeons, however, take a Dun & Bradstreet report on the income of the patient, and they charge in proportion to what they think they can get away with. In other words, if a person is wealthy, you sock them a higher fee for the same appendectomy or whatever. And they can only do that because they're associated with a hospital, which is basically with a monopolistic licensed institution. So, on the other hand, shrinks, mostly unhospital, more or less charge the same fees. I mean, within limits, shrinks are basically non-monopolistic in that sense. They charge more or less the same fee for everybody because they couldn't get away with charging more for the wealthy person. They just go to another shrink. And with inter-shrink competition will then do the job of making the price more or less uniform, but not with surgeons because they're locked into the hospital situation. AMA, for example, if you look at the power elite of the American Medical Association, invariably those who are running the association are surgeons, not internal medicine, not eye doctors, whatever, but surgeons. The editors of the Journal of the American Medical Association are surgeons, the heads of it. Why is that? It's not God ordained it has to be surgeons. The surgeons are the most monopolistic. They're in with a key of the monopoly, which is the hospital. And one of the things that are done with the shrinkage is you're getting blacks, women, and Jews out. You also get out competing therapies, those which don't fit in with orthodoxy. Now, I'm not taking a stand one way or the other. I'm not a physician. I'm not taking a stand on therapy one way or the other. What I'm saying is there are competing therapies. Orthodox therapy is not the only therapy. And in recent years, there's been a lot more of this, by the way, the last 10, 15 years, a cropping up of unorthodox therapy because there's been more competition in the medical field. You know, doctors are even advertising now. It's a magnificent step. They're forced to compete a little bit. which was unheard of, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. It's considered unethical to advertise. In other words, the ethics of medicine is you should never compete. Don't take a client away, a patient away from another doctor, because that's competition. In other words, it's an enforced cartel. It's been breaking up the last few years. So they put out of business competing therapies. In other words, there was in those days, before 1910, there were two respectable forms of therapy. Current, what's now called medicine, which then was called allopathy, allopaths, the theory being that you cure diseases by massive doses of synthetic drugs to kill the germs. And there are other fields. Homeopathy was considered just as respectable for that. I would say about one-third or more physicians were homeopaths. Homeopaths had a very different theory. Their theory was synthetic drugs are no good. You use natural herbs in minute doses. I don't know. Who knows? But anyway, the thing is they had a good success rate, too. Their success rate was probably at least as good as the allopaths. They were put out of business. Every homeopathic medical school was destroyed by the state government regulation after 1910. The American Medical Association, which are allopath, and therefore put the homeopath out of business. In Europe, they still have a lot of homeopaths, a very respectable occupation. In the United States, however, they've been put out of business by the government. And with allopathy, using the government to crush homeopathy. There are other forms of path, naturopath, osteopath, who used to be illegal and now in chiropractic finally made it. But it's a long struggle to get legalized. Also, of course, a lot of alleged cancer cures have been outlawed by the government. Not on the basis that they do any harm, but on the basis that they're not effective. How do you know they're not effective? Well, I mean, it should be up to the patient to decide, I think, to make. There was a case on television a couple of weeks ago of Dr. Ruvici, a lovable Romanian doctor, about 85 years old, had a lot of cancer patients, doing a lot of good, apparently, at least the patient testified to that. His license was taken away from him by the state government, so they said his therapy was not effective, quote-unquote. The other hand, you have a lot of butchery going on by Orthodox medicine, and they say, well, sorry, that's our mistake, it was the way it is. Even though it's not considered ineffective, because that's the state of the art. That's the state of art, you can get away with it. So it seems to be a pretty rum deal to outlaw a cure just because it's, quote, not effective, unquote, according to the government, not according to the patient. And so Laetrile has been outlawed, the use of Hoxie cure, whatever these, however good or bad they are, people should be able to take to buy them. Incidentally, look at the basic argument of Orthodox medicine. Look at the argument. They don't say it's these cures are harmful. What they say is they're not effective, and therefore they're wasting the patient's money. Imagine these goddamn doctors having the gall to claim that other cures are wasting patients' money. They're much cheaper than Orthodox medicine, much cheaper. which is the big reason why they're being declared illegal. They're very cheap. Natural herbs are cheap. The Ruvici method is cheap. Laetrile is cheap. It's basically orange pits. Orange pits? Almond pits. Peach pits. Peach pits. Apricot pits. That's it. Anyway, they're fairly cheap. Apricot pits are not that difficult to come by. At any rate, they're cheap. And so, And most people, 90% of the people who go to so-called quack cures have already gone through Orthodox medicine declared incurable. And they turn to these quack cures only as a last resort in most cases. So there's a tremendous amount of gall these people say that they're wasting the consumer money. At any rate, so there we have it. We have a lot of these people test. A friend of mine claims he was cured of diabetes by taking a homeopathic herb. And you have an herb of this much, like $3.50 of an herb, 5 year supply of an herb. That's it. He threw away his insulin and that was it. So it's much cheaper. And less side effects to boot. So at any rate, homeopathy should definitely be legal, whether it's good or bad. It should be, consumers should have a right to patronize it. interestingly enough, a method to the madness here. The allopaths, remember, express synthetic drugs. Synthetic drugs are expensive. Synthetic drugs also have to be discovered by, and the research has to be done into them by drug companies. And we're therefore particularly interested in putting the natural herbs out of business. Remember I said the Flexner Report, Abraham Flexner, who wrote the report which changed medical education in this country, was not a doctor and he was not an educator, oddly enough. So why did he get this big plum deciding on who should be out of business? His brother was Simon Flexner, who was a doctor, who was also head of the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research. The Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research has been pushing ever since synthetic drug research. Most of their money goes into synthetic drug research. The synthetic drug companies are heavily invested in by the Rockefeller family, Rockefeller interests. So now we begin to have a connection here. We have the Rockefeller drug interests making a lot of money out of synthetic drugs. We have the Rockefeller Foundation, allegedly impartial, objective scientific outfit, pushing for outlawing of competitors to synthetic drugs. And Rockefeller reaps the profits along with the medical cartelists at the expense of the consumer population. I'm not saying that this is the economics of the situation. I'm not taking a stand for or against any of these therapies. What I'm saying is the consumer should be allowed to choose. That's the, at any rate. In the last few years, the medical monopoly has been loosened a lot. There's been a big increase of people going to medical school. They've had to advertise. There's been a loosening up of one of the reasons was the medical prices of drugs and medicine in hospitals have been so high that competition has been coming in, paramedics and people like that. Holistic medicine, all these things are much cheaper. And finally pushed back the monopoly stranglehold on medicine to some extent, not completely, but things are a lot better than they used to be. I remember when I first went out to California many years ago and the dentists were advertising on the radio. It was really a culture shock, you know. turn the radio on, go to Dr. So-and-so, give cheap fillings for 10 bucks or whatever it is. And now, of course, there's a lot more of it. You got leaflets saying, you know, go to this hospital and go to this clinic. But it's a good thing. It shows there's some competition at last in the medical field. So anyway, the monopoly problem is not falling the man curve. It's compulsory cartelism. I just want to say a footnote on a farm question, farm price supports, which again are cartelized agriculture. And the milk, you have the milk cartel, compulsory milk cartel, with restriction of supply and rise in price. Well, the milk people are still bellyaching about the price isn't high enough. And it's overproduction, quote unquote. In other words, there's still too much being produced. In order to crush the milk industry, in order to cartelize the milk industry further, the federal government has just issued a ruling, compulsory killing of 1 million dairy cows, the slaughter of them. Because if you do, it sounds like early 1930s, it's being done right now, in the name of, quote, free market, unquote. Compulsory slaughter of dairy cows is to push to decrease the supply of milk and push up the price. This is a welfare state in action, people, right? For the welfare of the goddamn dairy interests, at the expense of the rest of us. So interestingly enough, what's happening is they're killing the dairy cows. Usually, see, there are two kinds of cows, the dairy cows and beef cattle, okay? The dairy cows are milked and the beef cattle are killed for meat. But they're killing the dairy cows, they're selling them for meat. So the beef cattle industry is going crazy. They're saying, hey, there's a big overproduction of cattle because there's now too much meat coming on the market. Meat prices are falling. Because there's too much cattle coming on the market, so they're calling for stopping the slaughter of dairy cattle. They don't care what they do with them. They're going to disappear somewhere. They don't want them competing with the beef cattle on the meat market. Such is the situation. This is the latest development. So I'll keep you apprised as the term goes on. Okay, enough for today.